May it please the court. Assistant Jefferson County Attorney Ryder Mott, bar number 33148, on behalf of the Jefferson County Sheriff Ted Mink and Deputy Sheriff John Hodges. The question for the court today is whether the sheriff and Deputy Hodges are entitled to immunity from claims that Deputy Hodges did not properly secure the plaintiffs, who were juvenile defendants, prior to transporting them to a juvenile correction facility following court hearings. The sheriff defendants raised immunity under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act before the trial court, and this court requested the parties address two additional grants of immunity afforded law enforcement under the Children's Code. I would like to start briefly today by addressing the grant of immunity afforded law enforcement under subsection 7 of CRS 19-2-508. This provision, I think, provides actually the clearest grant of immunity given the circumstances presented in this case. Specifically, the relevant portion of CRS 19-2-508 subsection 7 holds that any law enforcement officer acting under the direction of the court who in good faith transports a juvenile shall be immune from civil and criminal liability that otherwise may result as such by reason of such act. Thus, in order to be entitled to immunity under CRS 19-2-508 subsection 7, three requirements must be satisfied. First, the individual seeking the immunity must be a law enforcement officer. It's undisputed that Deputy Hodges was. Plaintiff's second amended complaint states that Deputy Hodges was an officer in paragraph 8 and says that he was working in the course and scope of his employment in paragraph 41 of the second amended complaint. Second, one must be transporting juvenile inmates. This is exactly the scenario that's presented in the facts of this case. Plaintiff has pled in the second amended complaint. The plaintiffs were in state custody at Mount View Youth Services Center on the date of the accident and were being transported by the sheriff's office. The third requirement to be entitled to immunity is that transportation of juvenile inmates must be at the direction of a court. Here, both juvenile inmates were transported back to the juvenile detention facility following court-ordered appearances. Copies of the writs of each plaintiff were attached to the sheriff defendant's notice of supplemental authority. And further, this court has authority to take judicial notice of those court-ordered writs. It is undisputed, therefore, that all three criteria necessary for establishing immunity under CRS 19-2-5087 are present here, and it should be noted that unlike the grant of immunity under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, there are no exceptions to the immunity provided law enforcement officers transporting juvenile detainees under CRS 19-2-508 subsection 7. Therefore, this court should reverse the order of the trial court and find that the sheriff defendants are entitled to immunity from damages for the juvenile transport in this case. It's important to note that the immunity afforded under 19-2-508 subsection 7 bars not only plaintiff's claims related to allegedly failing to secure the juvenile defendants in the transport van, but also would bar their claims to the extent they are seeking damages related to Deputy Hodges' alleged negligent driving of the vehicle in paragraph 37 of the second amended complaint. Thus, CRS 19-2-508 subsection 7 serves as a total bar to plaintiff's claims against the sheriff defendants.
Why should we interpret that as a jurisdictional bar, as the CGIA is, versus an affirmative defense?
Well, I think since it provides immunity would mean it's a jurisdictional bar.
Are all statutes phrased in terms of immunity jurisdictional?
Well, I think.
Like a Good Samaritan, for example, is immune from suit, but does that mean divest the court of jurisdiction?
Well, I think in this case, since it's a total bar based on transporting juvenile inmates, I think this court has authority, as I indicated, to consider the writs which we attached in the notice of supplemental authority, take judicial notice of those, and then all three requirements would be satisfied. I believe that it is a jurisdictional bar for that reason. So, the second source of immunity, which is extensively briefed and which this court requested we focus the crux of our time here today, is the immunity afforded government actors under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, and specifically 2410-106. The Governmental Immunity Act generally protects government actors from tort claims, except in cases where there has been a waiver of the immunity. At issue here is the waiver of governmental immunity for the operation of a motor vehicle and whether that waiver encompasses a duty to restrain and secure inmates in a prisoner transport van prior to driving the vehicle. This court has addressed the scope of the waiver for the operation of a motor vehicle on at least five separate occasions. And in those cases, this court has essentially found two types of activities that fall within the scope of that operation of a motor vehicle. The first being the actual driving of the motor vehicle, including actions that are incidental to the driving, such as stops made by the vehicles. And then the second category is issues related to faulty maintenance of vehicles. The two cases that specifically addressed the actual driving of the vehicle are Johnson versus RTD 916 P2D 619, Colorado Appeals 1995, and Cowledge versus Alfreds 969 P2D 743, Colorado Appeals 1998. Johnson involved a case in which a passenger was let out of an RTD bus at a non-designated stop and was hit by a passing vehicle. The court in that case found that the operation of a motor vehicle involves the actual driving of the vehicle, and which would include the stopping and starting of a vehicle. Cowledge involved a snowplow driver in Fremont County who filled up a cattle guard with snow and dirt, and which allowed horses to walk across the cattle guard and were later struck by the plaintiff who was driving a vehicle. Specifically in Cowledge, the court again reaffirmed that operation means any act or omission of the public employee in driving a motor vehicle. This court then in the Harris case, in Harris versus RTD 15P3D 782, Colorado Appeals 2000, broadened the definition of the operation of motor vehicle by extending the operation of motor vehicle to include issues of faulty maintenance. Harris was a case in which a passenger of an RTD bus slipped and fell on steps going into the bus where there was accumulated snow and ice.
Mr. Mott, let me ask you about Harris, because I think that may be a little bit closer to the issue that we have here. So as far as broadening the issue to faulty maintenance, it did not involve the maintenance of the vehicle itself, the structure of the vehicle, but involved maintenance that affected the safety of the passengers. So I'd like you to address that piece of it and how this case would be different.
Yeah, I think specifically in Harris, RTD specifically said that one of the maintenance issues it instructed its drivers to do was to clear out the steps on snowy days, and that they considered that part of the maintenance to make sure that the vehicle was safe for people getting in and out of the vehicle. In this case, I don't think there was any sort of, I just don't think it's a similar requirement that you seatbelt someone. It's not related to the actual driving of the vehicle. In this case, the seatbelting was done before the vehicle was moving. It wasn't related to the actual driving. And it's not a matter of maintenance in the sense that there's no allegations in the complaint that the seatbelt didn't work properly, wasn't properly maintained, that they didn't check the safety equipment of the vehicle. So from that perspective, I don't think it falls under the faulty maintenance.
Mr. Mott, if I put my six-year-old grandson in the right front seat and I don't belt him and I don't give him a car seat and I'm driving, can I get a ticket for that?
Absolutely.
So I'm operating the motor vehicle contrary to the rules applicable to operating the motor vehicle.
Right, but I don't think there's any similar law here which would impose that duty.
So if there was a law or regulation imposing a duty on the driver here, the deputy, to ensure that the passengers are belted, then that would make a difference?
Well, I think there's two components to answering that question. One, I think, is if there was a law requiring it, that might establish some sort of duty to do that. And then the second question is whether that duty falls under the definition of operation of a motor vehicle under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. Because certainly just because there's a duty, I don't think alone, that doesn't mean that there's been a waiver. So then it goes to that second point. I think the issue here, and one way we can look at this issue differently to show why restraining inmates prior to driving the vehicle may not fall under faulty maintenance or driving of a vehicle is, you know, under this interpretation adopted by the trial court and urged by the plaintiffs, if an officer was loading inmates into a transport van and failed to properly secure them, and one inmate attacked another inmate, that would fall under the waiver as defined by the trial court. And I think that shows you how far that is from the actual operation of a motor vehicle. If you had that sort of type of incident. And I think that's sort of akin, I would point the court to the Valenzuela decision of the United States District Court, which involved, a sexual assault, alleged sexual assault by an officer against someone who was stopped for a DUI. And in that case, the court noted that the waiver would not extend to injuries arising out of activity conducted in the vehicle, and that was not the operation of a motor vehicle.
Mr. Mott, let me just ask you, the trial court here made a distinction whether the activity would be part of the function of the driver or not. And do you think that that's a useful rule here? Because I realize in the cases you just pointed out, it was act of a third party that impacted the safety of the passengers. But here the court was saying this would be the function of the driver. So is that useful in our analysis?
Well, you know, if that was the case, would, any time an officer loads an inmate or puts an inmate into a car, into a squad car following an arrest, would that be, and the person gets injured, would there be a waiver of immunity? I don't think so. I mean, again, I think there has to be some limit on the scope of that definition of the operation of a motor vehicle. Otherwise, you know, the exceptions sort of swallow up the rule. So at this time, I'd like to reserve my remaining time. So thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Maren Johnson, bar number 40944, on behalf of plaintiff appellees Michael Young et al. The district court denial of appellant's motion to dismiss should be upheld, and I will start by addressing Colorado Revised Statute 19.5508, subsection 7, as it was addressed by counsel for appellants. While he laid out three parts of that statute that have to be met, what he forgot to mention was that there is a good faith qualifier in that statute. While it says that good faith shall be presumed, it doesn't necessarily say that that is an irrebuttable presumption. And so as Judge Webb pointed out, it's not necessarily a jurisdictional bar, but rather an affirmative defense. And we still have that good faith as a qualifier that was put into the statute, presumably. If we didn't have a rebuttable presumption, then they would just say there's a bar for when you're transporting juveniles under a writ. Also, there's a case on point with that that looked at a statute which was actually the no-fault statute, which is no longer a valid statute, however the case law is. And with that, the court determined it was the Supreme Court of Colorado, and that is Colby versus Progressive Insurance, 928 P2D 1298, and that's a 1996 decision. And they found that, well, if they intend for the statute to have a irrebuttable presumption, they would have used different language. So in that, they just said there is a presumption, similar to in this, with regard to this statute. They looked at Colorado Revised Statute 841-206, which stated that it shall be conclusively presumed. And the court determined that if that had been the intention, that it was conclusive presumption for statute 841-206, that they would have put that definitive language in, as opposed to just shall be presumed, which is similar with the case here. There was no good faith conduct on behalf of the deputy transporting the juveniles. Unfortunately, the statute does not specifically define good faith, and when that's the case, we have to look to general definitions of good faith. Basically, Black's Law Dictionary defines it as honesty of intention and freedom from knowledge of circumstances which ought to put the holder upon inquiry. And here, there are circumstances that put the deputy on inquiry. He knows that the juveniles are handcuffed. They are not able to secure themselves properly in the vehicle. He also has the duty to secure juveniles under the age of 16 in the vehicle, as was pointed out by Judge Tidball in her order. And that's Colorado Revised Statute 424-236. Here, at the time of the incident, plaintiff Dylan Busey was age 16 and plaintiff Daniel Larson was age 15. And so, as found by Judge Tidball in her order, under Colorado Revised Statute 424-236, he would have the duty to restrain the minors in the van. And again, I think that puts him on notice and that he should have secured the minors. Again, he has the duty under that statute, and he is aware that they are handcuffed and unable to secure themselves properly in the vehicle. Thus, I do not believe that 19-508 subsection 7 would operate as an absolute immunity to liability for Jefferson County Sheriff and for the deputy. With regard to whether or not the conduct of the deputy in failing to secure the minors while they were boarding the van falls within operation of motor vehicle, I think this has been addressed by the court, specifically in Harris, which, while counsel argues that it is a maintenance issue, as I believe Judge Lichtenstein pointed out, it's not the maintenance of the actual bus. It's not a faulty defect on the bus itself. Rather, it has something to do with the ingress and egress of the vehicle. In that case, in Harris, it was removing snow and ice from the steps. And they determined in Harris that the waiver of immunity for operation of the motor vehicle includes boarding, and that's what was done here. The deputy sheriff boarded these juveniles onto the van. He failed to secure them. Again, they were handcuffed and unable to secure themselves. And so I think it's directly on point with the Harris case, where, again, it has to do with the ingress and egress or boarding or exiting of the vehicle. Similar to the Johnson case, where counsel, again, argued that that was incidental to the driving of the bus. However, it's synonymous with loading a vehicle. There, the vehicle was not, the bus was not moving. In Johnson, it had stopped. The passenger had exited, was not even in the process of exiting the bus, was actually crossing the street, was hit by another vehicle. And that was found to come within operation of a motor vehicle waiver. Similar here, we just have the flip side of that where we are loading the van. It's also stopped, so you're not in the actual movement of the vehicle, but the same is the case with Harris and with Johnson.
But these passengers weren't injured in the process of loading. I mean, this is not a slippery step that then someone slips on and is injured because of the failure to act. And here, these passengers weren't injured while boarding, were they?
That's correct. They were not injured while boarding, but I think it's directly on point with the Johnson case, where the passenger was not injured while actually exiting the bus. They had already completed the exit of the bus. They had started to cross the road on their own incentive, crossed the road and was hit by another vehicle. And in that case, the bus had just stopped improperly and was not stopped at a designated stop.
Let me ask you, relying on Johnson, but didn't Stockwell limit Johnson and it only recognizes a waiver when the actions are necessary to the operation of the vehicle? And I'd like you to address that limitation language.
Certainly, and I think in Stockwell that they point out as well that boarding is encompassed in the operation as it pertains to motor vehicles in the context of 2410.106 subsection 1A. And so in the Stockwell case, again, as Your Honors pointed out, that was the case where a third party was responsible for the injuries, and it didn't have to deal with anything that the driver had done. Essentially, it was an assault on the bus, similar to the Valenzuela case that counsel pointed out as well, where you have an officer doing a traffic stop and was allegedly assaulted the woman who he had pulled over. And so I think that while Stockwell does not find that that specific factual situation came within the waiver, they did acknowledge that boarding of the vehicle still did come within that waiver. And again, here, that's essentially what we have is a duty, first of all, for the officer to secure the juveniles, which was not completed. And then the juveniles were not able to secure themselves, and that's inherent in the boarding of these juveniles onto the van. And I think it's also important to look at the purpose of the Children's Code, which is the two sections that were raised sua sponte by the court. And really, while it's to rehabilitate offenders in the actual construction of the statute, it's also to provide a safe atmosphere and to make sure that these offenders are getting on the right path. It's not to take away any due process that they may have. And again, I think that under 42 subsection, I'm sorry, Article 42 for 236, again, the officer would have that duty to properly secure the juveniles, which he failed to do. With regard to the other statute that was raised by the court, 19-2-404, I just want to very briefly address that. I think in the Gilmore case, which is Gilmore versus Concerned Parents of Pueblo, the Court of Appeals found that subsection 1 and subsection 2 work in connection with each other, and that it has to be in a situation where there's a response to issues of control and restraint. Here we don't have a situation where the deputy is responding to issues of control or restraint over the individuals. There's not something where the individuals are in custody, they're acting out, and they had to go control and restrain them. And so it points that out in the Gilmore case, which is 28P3D963. So I think that there is no immunity provided under that statute for those reasons, because again, there was no response to an issue of control or restraint. I think the only argument that could be made is here we're asserting that they failed to properly secure them, and I guess that could be taken as control, but I think it's just looking at the plain language of the statute, that statute does not apply. Again, with regard to the waiver for operation of the motor vehicle, I think that it's been determined by this court that boarding is something that comes within the waiver of immunity. And that is the factual situation that we have in this case again. I think Harris is directly on point. Again, while counsel asserts that it is a maintenance issue, it's not a faulty defect with the bus. It really does have to deal with ingress and egress and loading and unloading of a vehicle. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to address two or three of the issues real quickly raised by counsel for the plaintiffs. In particular, I think the issue with respect to Johnson, the court makes a good point. In the Stockwell case, and again recognized in the Cowage case, Stockwell specifically limited the holding of Johnson to the meaning that the operation of a motor vehicle means only those acts or omissions of a public employee in driving the motor vehicle. And I think the trial.
Pay him driving? Is that what it says?
That's the language. He's quoting from Johnson on page 745 and 746 of Cowage. The court noted that the term operation means any act or omission of the public employee in driving a motor vehicle. And this limited the scope of the language to only those actions of the public employee that are necessary to the operation of the motor vehicle. And again, I think the court makes a great point that in the Harris case, the person was actually injured in the boarding of the vehicle, and that's not the circumstances that are occurred here. Additionally, again.
So let me interrupt you again. So let's say the public employee driver is required to wear glasses and is not wearing glasses. Is that necessary to the operation of a motor vehicle? I mean, I can operate it without glasses. I just can't see.
Right. Well, but I think in that case, in order to be able to, operate and drive it in a safe manner, that's necessary. But I don't think that same sort of analysis applies to the belting in of inmates. I don't think that's necessary to the actual driving of the vehicle. I just think, again, that there's a separation there, and here that would mean the scope of the waiver is so broad that, virtually anything related to, someone coming up to the vehicle or being assaulted on the vehicle would fall within the scope of the waiver. And I think that violates the common sense meaning or the basic meaning of operation of motor vehicle, which the court adopted in its prior decisions.
We have to draw the line somewhere. We have to find a logical place to draw the line. I understand you're saying we have to draw this side of an assault between prisoners.
But
let me ask you this: the necessary in the operation of a motor vehicle, would that not include compliance with all laws pertaining to the operation of a motor vehicle?
Well, I think that's a good point. I think specifically, though, with respect to 424236, I don't think the trial court made the necessary findings to find that was applicable. First, that the vehicle here was one of the vehicles covered based on the weight limits, and two, only one of the two inmates was a minor under that provision, so certainly it wouldn't apply to one of the two plaintiffs in this case. From that perspective, I don't think that provision necessarily applies, or the court made necessary findings to find the applicability of it to the circumstances here, which would be necessary first to have that impose the duty or have that tie it to the operation of a motor vehicle. I see my time's up, but
thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. We also appreciate your calming us to get this case rescheduled quickly. The case is submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.